Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and soon-to-be Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and you can reach us at our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and have our show delivered to your computer every day that we put one up. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis. How are you doing today?
Doing just ducky this morning. How are you?
I am as duck-like as well.
But we're going to talk mostly today about fish. We have coming on the show a little bit later. We have Oscar.
Ducks eat fish.
Ducks do eat fish, in fact. That's true.
Look at that.
We have coming on the show later on Oscar Schofield, who's an associate professor of marine biology and ocean optics and a pretty cool dude. And he's going to be talking with us about Hurricane Katrina, the hurricane season, hurricanes in general, and its effect on the food supply. I mean, there's some pretty interesting stuff going on. Louisiana and the Gulf Coast are an important source of food and commerce in America, as of course we all know. And I think that we will be interesting to talk with him about what exactly is going on underwater some of the long-term effects of the hurricane might be. But let's start talking about a little bit more humorous aspect of fish. Star-Kissed Tuna came out with a new pack that was...
very impressive packaging here.
Hopefully going to be recalled soon. It's a pack that has five individual bags of tuna, and it says five lunches, one for every day of the week.
So we just sleep through Saturday, Sunday? That's it? It's the old Rip Van Winkle through the weekend?
They got to get a new proofreader at Star-Kissed. That probably cost them a lot of money. But on a higher note, or a better note, there is a new tuna on the market. And you and I, Mark, have had this tuna very often. But when we think tuna, we think Japanese, because the Japanese really dominate the tuna market, especially on the super high end. But there is, in many regions of Italy, tuna is very important as well. Ventresca is to Italian tuna what Toro is to Japanese tuna. They're both terms that talk about the extra fatty belly meat. And now Zoe, a Spanish company that makes very good olive oil,
and that belly meat is very frequently eaten raw.
Yeah, it's just the best of the best, and it's the most expensive as well. But Zoe, the Spanish company that makes a pretty good extra virgin olive oil, has introduced a canned Ventresca in olive oil. This is pretty interesting. And Italians have a tradition of canned tuna, like really, really good canned
tuna.
Right,
not like the tuna, not Star-Kissed, not our supermarket, chicken of the sea.
Our supermarket tuna is usually... It's sort of like the sawdust of the tuna that gets put in the can around here. But this is really good, and it's not cheap, but it's also very good. And you'll notice that the pale meat in Ventresca tuna, it separates like out into leaves. You can get it at Balducci's. You can get it at Balducci's online. We'll put a link up on our website where you can find some. And this is really good, like whole pieces of tuna, because it's not sawdust.
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as names go, chicken of the sea is probably like the most appropriate, because really good tuna costs like $20 a pound,
right,
and really good chicken costs like $4 a pound.
Right.
So when you say chicken of the sea, what you're really saying is, well, like the $4 a pound stuff.
Well, it was. I mean, that came about in a time when America was a little more averse to where our Americans' palates weren't as developed, and we tried to say, you know, to get people Americans to eat anything, you'd be like,
tastes like chicken.
It tastes like chicken. What do frogs like? Like chicken. Then why don't I just eat a chicken?
Alligator tastes like chicken.
I have to share with you a funny story. I always remember that, and I think what's great and interesting and funny, but and fun about owning a restaurant, is there is a certain amount of education that goes on. I mean, we're not there to teach people stuff, but we're there to bring new things to people. And so when we brought in Austrian pumpkin seed oil in 1996, when nobody else was bringing it into the country, that was exciting.
It's still exciting. I love Austrian pumpkin seed oil.
Well, a lot of people have it now, though. It was on the cover of Art Culinaire. What trendsetters we are.
Yeah, we are trendsetters, but one of my favorite results of that was the Austrian pumpkin seed ice cream.
Yeah.
Awesome
Just
stuff.
To explain what that is it's a traditional... a condiment made from a specific kind of pumpkin seed in Styria, which was the breadbasket of Austria for a long time. And it's amazing, amazing stuff. And if you want to learn more about it, we'll put that up on our website as well. It's made by small farmers in Styria. And it's an absolutely beautiful oil. And there was literally none imported into the United States that we could find. And so we brought some back ourselves. And, you know, we call it a suitcase import.
Suitcase import,
and
exactly.
We would treat it like gold and use it on some special dishes. And that was really...
But that really doesn't have anything to do with seafood at all.
No,
but
it doesn't.
We digress as usual.
So here in the teaching people new stuff category, I will always remember that I was tableside. And I was talking to a woman. And, you know, I mean, we'll jump in and pick up a table here and there. And we would do that even more in years gone by. And I said, you know, and tonight I have a special tuna, and it's grilled on the wood-burning grill. And the woman just looked at me like I had three heads all of a sudden. And I went on to explain it, and she said, now, the tuna, that's grilled? I said, yeah. She said, you grill the tuna? I said, yeah. So, well, I've never heard of anything like that. I'll have the grilled tuna. And I thought, okay, great. And I came out, and I placed the tuna in the
fryer. Tuna is great on a wood-burning grill, by the way. It gets very rich from the smoky and delicious.
Come on, grilled tuna is not, like, totally new and adventurous. Mm-hmm. So I came back out, and I put the tuna in front of her. Because I'm curious. I want to be sure that she likes it. And I said, and she looks at me, and I said, how is it? She said, it's amazing. I said, well, she said, you know, I couldn't figure out how you kept the little pieces of tuna from falling in between the grill. She's thinking I was going to grill a can of tuna. No.
Tuna comes from a whole fish.
Yeah.
There is actually a fish that swims in the water.
Swimming around
called
in the
tuna,
ocean.
And it's actually a fairly big fish.
All right.
So it doesn't have to come out as particle board.
Some other things that are good. Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to talk about, you were talking about that tuna that bathes in oil, but one of the things that you and I had for a long time, we had that sardine. Made by MadRose.com.
MadRose is, yeah.
The importer. Made the importer. Oh, they were unbelievable. In olive oil, and you could age them, and you had to rotate the can so that they stayed bathed in olive oil.
Here's an underrated food for Americans. A lot of times we avoid oily fish.
I thought I hated sardines, by the way, until I tasted these sardines, and until I had fresh sardines, I thought I hated sardines.
And now we deal with them a lot. Now sardines can be really great, and we're used to, you know, sardines that are sort of mediocre in a can, and, you know, they can be okay if you really
and been
like
in a can for a really long time.
There are two kinds of there are two ways that we use sardines that are really great. One is there's a company, they're Quiberonnais, and they are the big, beautiful skin-on sardines. Mm-hmm. Like you get like four to a large
four in a
can.
There are four in one of those really in like a big can of sardines. So they're and they're sardine. They're squished in there.
And actually, like sardines in a can. Well, the interesting thing about these is that they age and they improve with age. And you can get them with a little slice of lemon preserved in there with the olive oil. They're packed in olive oil. And as they can be 2 years old and 3 years old, and they get better.
And they will get better, right?
With time.
There's a little lemon in the package
like a
as
wine.
Well. And it just continues to add flavor and get
and
more,
I've had
more
them
delicate.
Like 2 or 3 years old, and they're better with time, like a wine. And the other way,
but nothing's better than fresh sardines, Francis. I'm sorry. Even you know, I fell in love with those Quiberonnais sardines, but fresh sardines. And again, I thought that I hated sardines, but I don't hate sardines. Fresh sardines are magnificent.
But they need to be like fresh, like right out of the
super
water.
Super fresh.
Because those oily fish get stinky
they
very
get gamey
soon.
Very quickly.
When we come back, we're going to be talking to Oscar Schoenfeld, who is an associate professor of marine biology at Rutgers, and we're going to be talking about the hurricane and the effect on the food supply. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Oscar Schoenfeld, who's an associate professor of marine biology and ocean optics at Rutgers University. And we're here to talk about Hurricane Katrina seafood and the nation's food supply. Hi, Oscar.
Oscar, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Oscar, are you there?
Yep.
Hey, man. Sorry.
Oscar was just gathering his
notes. The beginning
notes
part
for
of the show was a little boring.
No problem.
How you doing?
Good, good.
So let's talk about what's gone on or what's going on and what's going to continue to go on down in the Gulf. I mean, the Gulf supplies 25% of the nation's seafood, and so there's have to be some pretty significant implications from this storm and about the ocean itself and about the fishing industry. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the most immediate thing you're going to see is the impact on the fishery itself in terms of the fishermen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, when you wipe out all the shrimping boats, you know, that's not something you can replace quickly.
Right,
right.
You know?
Right.
And those fishing vessels that anchor a lot of the fishing stuff there are really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of it's like they're held within families and passed within families or by big corporations, and they take a long time to build. And so I think that prices are going to go up initially just because there's going to be much fewer people out there fishing.
Yeah, this wasn't too far from the Forrest Gump scenario.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
I mean, they actually lost 40% of their fishing boats.
Yeah.
It's a $2.6 billion industry down there. And you're just talking about massive, massive losses.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other thing I think you're going to see are those things, probably like shellfish, this, or even some shrimp, where you're going very near the coast, is that whole coastal region has probably changed.
Right.
You know, we're flushing probably a huge amount of stuff out of the, you know, the cities and the wetlands and everything like this. There's probably a huge amount of organic material being dumped.
Well, is the water now toxic? Is there an issue with
in
that?
In the city, but you know, if you're eating an oyster from in New Orleans itself, you know, in terms of, I think that the main place you would not want to eat now is Lake Pontchartrain.
Yeah.
And Lake Pontchartrain had really started coming back nicely over the last decade.
Yeah.
Pontchartrain's famous, you know, like when you drive along the south and there's a lot of those shells on the side of the road?
Right.
Sure.
Most of those came from Pontchartrain for years. They were just harvesting it, you know.
Right.
So it was in a real bad place. Sturgeon had finally started showing back up.
Really?
You know, big sort of, you know, turtles and some beautiful seafood starting to show up.
So what's happened to the marine life?
The marine life there, well, one, you got to pump all that water from the city that is toxic into the lake. It's a huge lake,
right.
You know. However, you know, if your fish is swimming around, how do you know it wasn't hanging out in that nasty water?
Sure.
Right.
You know, so I think it's going to take a while for that to flush out.
How long do you think that'll take? How long do you think it'll take for nature to heal that?
I think in terms of flushing it, I think you'll probably, by spring, have cleared a lot of stuff out.
Okay.
You know, I mean, some real nasty stuff might sink and be caught in the sediments and everything like that.
What about the filter fish? What about, you know, shellfish and things like that, things that are on the bottom and
yeah,
actually...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like for Pontchartrain, you're probably going to see much fewer shellfish being harvested, even if they're there. Because if you're dumping a lot of nasty stuff into the lake, it's going to end up in the shellfish.
Right.
Because they concentrate everything.
Sure.
And so... You know, with everything that's been caught in that city water, you know, you're not going to want to eat any of that.
Sure.
When you say, Oscar, that they may find that whole the ocean landscape has changed when they go back to fish it, how do you mean?
I mean, like, you know, when we think of, like, a shoreline, that whole shoreline shape, areas that used to be very productive fishery, well, there might have been a huge amount of sediment dumped in that area or moved away from that area. So even if you got your boat up, your classical fishing grounds might be somewhat altered.
So they're shifted and you need to find new places to go.
Yeah, and then, you know, it'll take some time for then the new life to flourish in the areas that are favorable or not favorable. Also, whenever you have these big storm events, what you do is you flush, the rivers flush into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they carry a huge amount of organic material.
Okay.
And so what happens? Well, bacteria go, hey, there's a party, lots of organic material.
We don't really like bacteria parties.
And so they eat it, and what they do is they consume the oxygen. So the most famous example down there is the Mississippi Plume of Death. You know,
tell us about the Mississippi
plume of death. So there's the
doesn't sound like a good thing.
Sounds like it's showing at midnight at the Brunswick Square Cinema.
Yeah, no, it's pretty much, you know, a great B movie. So essentially,
Freddy meets Jason meets the Mississippi Plume of Death.
Yep, and Jason would not have a chance against that plume of death.
So tell us about that.
So there's a huge slug of water associated with Mississippi that's entering into the Gulf of Mexico that has no oxygen.
Right now.
It's been growing over the years. And the reason it's growing is those rivers flush that organic material out. The bacteria go crazy. They eat all that organic material and use up the oxygen.
Wow.
And so if you think of the Mississippi, it's collecting all the nutrients and everything from the entire heartland of the country.
Right.
Oh,
all the fertilizers.
Right.
And so you
fertilizer being bad for a river.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like they're all, you know, a lot of rivers are going to be turbid with a lot of material, but, you know, we know that we're loading a huge amount of fertilizer into the Mississippi. And what happens is when that water hits the clear ocean water, you got lots of nutrients, you got lots of organic material, you got lots of activity, and you deplete the oxygen. And so that zone of low oxygen ocean water is been growing over time.
And will this storm add to the size of the Mississippi plume of death?
Like initially, the initial thing effect of the storm might have been to actually help it slightly by, you know, essentially mixing everything up and getting oxygen down there.
Right.
But now we're also seeing all the flushing associated with all these rains and everything. And so the Mississippi now is dumping tons of material out there.
Oh, my God. We're going to talk more about this. We're talking about the biological and marine implications of the storm and the effect on the nation's food and fish supplies with Oscar Schoenfeld. Schoenfeld, an associate professor of marine biology and ocean optics at Rutgers, and we'll be talking with him more about that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Today we're talking with Oscar Schoenfeld, associate professor of marine biology and ocean optics at Rutgers University. And we're talking a little bit about the effects of Hurricane Katrina. And Oscar, you were just talking a little bit about the Mississippi plume of death, which we are not crazy about, we think. We'd rather not have that. Can we get rid of that?
Probably not.
Now, is this, what we talked about, just to recap for those who just tuned in, is that the Mississippi River is so polluted and treated with such disregard that this, before the storm, by the time the water opens out into the Gulf, we have, it's so deoxygenated that it
from the bacteria
starts to kill things in its path and pollutes the ocean. How big is the Mississippi plume of death?
When it's very big, it's the size of a small state.
That's incredible.
And like Rhode Island or like New Jersey?
Let me just sort of clarify. So you have all this material flowing out,
yep.
And it's fueling then the ocean to consume it.
Right.
And then that's what is depleting the oxygen.
Right. The organisms eat the nutrients, and then those organisms...
Yeah, they eat all the organic material.
Right.
So the organic material can be like the plants that have grown because of the nutrients. It can be organic stuff leached from soils, and so...
Now, when it goes out into the ocean, is the ocean cleaning that at all, or is that what's happening to it?
What happens is the ocean consumes it, and so then when the ocean consumes that material, the oxygen goes down, and the net impact of the low oxygen is, well, you can't have fish there.
Wow.
You know, so you'll have fish kills and stuff like that, you know, and sometimes when you have big storms like this, you know, you'll often see it followed by fish kills, you know, which is a likely event to happen around the New Orleans area and in Mississippi because of the same type of thing, a huge burst of activity, everything's mixed up, the biology sort of reacts to that, and the net result is oxygen levels decrease, and then fish need oxygen, they don't got it.
And again, I want to remind people that 25% of our nation's seafood comes from the Gulf area.
If we see a fish kill down there, Oscar, when about would you think that it would be likely to happen?
If there's a fish kill, I would expect, you know, you'd start seeing it soon. Let's say you mix everything up. It takes a week for the ocean to sort of react or the lakes to sort of react and the activity to start going, which is the first response.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And then after the system's had its little bacterial party, then the oxygen levels start decreasing, and that's usually a week or two afterwards.
My goodness. Our guest is Oscar Schoenfeld, associate professor of marine biology and ocean optics at Rutgers, and we're going to talk with him more in just a moment about the effects of Hurricane Katrina and what we're doing to our oceans and our little fishies. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with my partner, Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download the show on iTunes. Today, we're talking with Oscar Schoenfeld, who's a professor of marine biology at Rutgers University, and we're discussing the effects of Hurricane Katrina on the marine world down in the Gulf of Mexico. Oscar, one of the things that happened during this whole thing is we spilled 7 million gallons of oil into the Gulf from various places that it was being contained.
That seems like a lot.
What kind of – well, it's actually not as much as you would think. It's only two-thirds of what Exxon Valdez spilled. But what kind of effect is that going to have in that area?
The big thing when it comes to sort of oil spills is the grade of mm-hmm. the oil mm-hmm. that's spilled. And I don't know what kind was dumped. Some of it will float on the surface.
Right.
It's very volatile, meaning that it'll gas off
right.
the ocean relative to grade, which is the ideal.
Right. About 1.3 million gallons has already gassed off.
Yeah.
That's
and
already
so,
happened.
So, you know, and since they have refineries there and everything, I assume it's like, you know, the more light kind that, mm-hmm. you know, will essentially burn off. And
explain to us
quantity.
What gassing off is.
Essentially, it's essentially going to essentially flow out of the ocean and into the atmosphere.
So it evaporates, basically.
Yeah, you know, and it's floating on the ocean surface, so it heats up and then burns off.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you took it, like the Exxon Valdez or the oil spill that happened in, what was it, Vigo, Spain,
uh-huh.
a few years, it was a very heavy crude.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which sinks down to the seafloor and coats everything. And so when you talk about, like, oil spills, we always have the pictures of, like, the people scrubbing the birds and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm, right. But that's not the biggest problem.
That's, you know, where you've coated all the sea life with the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a long time for that to clear out because it's just sitting down there.
Where does it go, the heavy stuff that hits the bottom of the ocean, where does it go?
It sits there.
I mean, does it just sinks into the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah, and eventually gets buried. So, I mean, I grew up in California. And in the Santa Barbara area, and there's some natural fissures
yeah.
on the seafloor there. So there's always tar on the beach, you know, and it's not because there's, you know, oil rigs leaking a huge amount of oil. A lot of it's just naturally flowing out of the seafloor. And so you just have tar and scum. And,
so,
you know.
So that's a real tar beach as opposed to the one that we used to lay out on our roof?
Yeah, no, that was a real tar beach. So the old Indians used to use the chunks of tar to make their canoes waterproof.
Interesting.
You know, so, you know, the thing is, it's like, it just, it's not going to burn off. It's just going to sit there. It might get buried under stuff and all this type.
What will the long-term effect on the other fish be from all, I mean, you know, we had sewage treatment plants and garages full of all sorts of synthetic chemicals and automobiles and tanker trucks.
Paint cans and everything that's in your house.
And that's all being pumped into Lake Pontchartrain right now. What are going to be the long-term effects of that? Can Lake Pontchartrain recover from that?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the thing about nature is it's incredibly resilient.
Mm-hmm.
You might have one giant mutated snapping turtle or something like that.
Extraordinary. I can't wait to see that.
You might be able to read by the light of a halibut, but...
yeah.
Reopening?
Huh?
Coney Island's reopening with its two-headed turtles and...
Yeah. You know, I think it's like... I mean, if you look at what we used to do in the 70s and 80s where, like, lakes were catching on fire,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
or... You know, I actually lived down in that New Orleans area
uh-huh.
in the Lake District for a few years. And, you know, they would talk about the old days when you would drive through the neighborhoods with the DDT pesticides.
Yeah.
Sprayed just from cars onto the streets and sides of the road.
When I was a kid, the DDT truck would come down in Seaside Park, New Jersey, when we were down
there.
Yeah,
you'd chase it.
Yeah, you'd chase it on your bicycle. Yeah, I did, with the banana seat. Absolutely. Yeah.
And
I thought my mother was crazy saying, get in the house.
And you know what, Francis?
What?
You've just explained a lot.
Yeah.
I have a better understanding of you now.
My life. All right, now, were they doing a good job managing the fishery and the marine environment down in the Gulf prior to this storm, or was it being overfished?
I think the big thing down there is I think that there was heavy pressure on the shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
The shellfish, from what I heard, was doing reasonably well. And the big thing that's happening in sort of the U.S. in terms of fishing, you've got the commercial fishers, but recreational fishermen have become a huge voting block in the country.
Uh-huh.
They're very politically powerful.
And are they a good thing overall or
and
a bad
they
thing
tend
overall?
To be very much more of a conservation-oriented community. So, you know, you used to always go fishing for your swordfish and you'd kill it, you know. Now they do a lot of catch and tagging.
Catch and release.
You know, and a lot of this stuff, it doesn't mean that they don't represent a significant fraction of the fishing pressure, but they're very conscious that if you kill all the trophy fish, there are no trophy fish.
You know, I think that's the point of it all. You know, it's interesting because a corporation that is in fishing for however long fishing is profitable looks at the year-end statement, looks at what we're going to make now. And, you know, if in 5 years all the fish runs out, well, they'll get into something else. Whereas a fisherman, I think when people have a closer hunters, fishermen, when people have a closer connection with land and where your food comes from, that you sort of think in larger terms, and you look at, you know, when the fish start to decline and say, you know what, we need to do something about this.
Yeah, so I mean the big fish down there, I don't know the state of it, but fisheries in general are under a lot of pressure globally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we farm all our food except for fish, which we still pretty much hunt.
Right.
And so we're still hunters and gatherers. And we're really
More and more farming. I mean, certainly the
oyster
beds, certainly
salmon.
Yeah, I mean,
salmon, like, you
farming.
Know, most of the mm-hmm. salmon you get is Norwegian farm raised.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, but really, in terms of some of the major fish stocks, you know, swordfish, tuna,
right.
you know, those things that, you know, fuel whole countries and everything like that.
We've had, with the major fish stocks, I think one of the things that's really interesting and unfortunate is with a global economy where fish can be shipped anywhere overnight, you know, you have a worldwide demand if a certain fish becomes fashionable, like the Patagonian toothfish, for
Chilean
example,
sea bass,
which is called
right.
Chilean sea bass. And then we go out and we fish it, but we aren't fighting fair. I mean, if you locate schools of fish with helicopters and sonar, and then you employ fishing methods where you can take up an entire school of fish, you know, it's a different thing than fishing in a sustainable way. I mean, are modern fishing methods part of the problem?
I think, well, we're really good at killing things.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and, you know, there is a huge need to feed huge segments of the population. You know, if you look at Japan, it is an island that really relies on feeding, 170 million people.
Right.
Primarily with fish.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're very good at doing that. You know, the problem is it's hard to manage a fishery because we're still not even good about estimating the number that are there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also when you talk about managing ocean fisheries as opposed to lake fisheries, you're talking about something that's in international water. So
yeah.
if one country unilaterally stops fishing and another country picks up its slack,
right.
what have we done?
12 yeah. more boats, right.
And,
you know, and that's a huge issue that's very hard to resolve.
Well,
you know?
if you manage something locally, like if you want to manage how much game you hunt or some, you know, a local lake, that can be managed by a government that says, okay, well, this is how much anybody can pull out of it. And I think that's just a monstrous problem that we need to deal with overall. Listen, Oscar, I want to talk with you when we come back about the state of fishing fisheries overall and what's going on with the whole situation of global warming and increasing storms and storm surges across the country? Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Our guest is Oscar Schofield. He's the Associate Professor of Marine Biology and Ocean Optics at Rutgers University, and he's our guest today. We're talking about the effect of Hurricane Katrina and hurricanes in general and what it's going to have on our, the effect it's going to have on our food supply. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hey, back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and today our guest is Oscar Schofield. He's an associate professor of marine biology and ocean optics at Rutgers University, and we're talking about the hurricane and the effect it has on the fisheries and the food supply. Now, Oscar, some of the fish down there, some of the fish stocks had some pressure on them from overfishing. Now, a very sad fact is that we lost 40% of the fishing boats down there, and it's going to take a while for them to return. Is it possible that that could take some of the pressure off of some of these overfished stocks? Could there be a tiny little silver lining in this cloud?
Oh, I mean, definitely if you don't fish and it takes a few years, you'll see stock start to increase, you know. And for some of the things that we fish, like shrimp, that
right.
should happen relatively quickly,
right?
You know. And so we were talking about Forrest Gump earlier. Forrest Gump got really rich because he was the only boat out there.
Mm-hmm.
So there was still a lot of shrimp to be caught. But
right.
there wasn't 50 boats out there.
Right, right.
And, you know, that's very likely to be a scenario for certain types of fish or shellfish in the Gulf.
You know,
well, one of the things that there's been a lot of pressure on is American red snapper. And the Gulf area by Louisiana is one of the primary places that we catch American reds. One of the things that our listeners might not know is you can only catch and sell American red snapper from the 1st through the 14th of each month. That's something that's been regulated for a long time. When you've seen other red snapper in the marketplace, it's either been from Trinidad or it's another fish that looks like a red snapper.
If you're buying it late in the month.
Right, called a beeliner. And if somebody tells you they're selling you American red snapper on the 25th of the month, be skeptical.
Yeah.
And look, you're looking at an old fish.
You know, I know, Oscar, this is outside of your area of expertise, but one of the problems with shrimp, I mean, a foreign shrimp is dumped on the American market, and we have something like 75% of the fish that comes to the American market is from foreign shores, and fish shrimp basically isn't profitable. We had planned mm-hmm. on next week having a New Orleans shrimp fisherman.
Before Katrina hit.
And he's not going to be able to come on the show now because, well, he doesn't have a livelihood. But how I think it's very interesting to think how it will be possible for people to go and invest in fish boats when the people who owned the fish boats weren't making money to begin on the shrimpers mm-hmm. anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, the other thing for the shrimp, that's one of those fish foods, foods from the sea that are increasingly being farmed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if we go down to, like, Colombia's where I've been down on some of the shrimp farms there, and they're mammoth enterprises.
Right.
So they'll dig out a whole valley
mm-hmm.
and fill them with these, you know, 20 plots, 5 acres each, you uh-huh. know, of massive, you know, shrimp farms.
A lot of other countries are also heavily subsidizing their shrimp farms
yep.
to in order to bring them into the market and take market
take
share
market
from
share.
Yeah,
take
and then the market other thing is like a lot of other places don't have any environmental controls.
Right.
And so they'll push their stocks more than we push our stocks.
Right, and they'll screw the land and they don't care at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, and so that's just one of the big issues, you know, in terms of the global market.
I want to talk about, are these storms increasing? Are these hurricanes increasing in strength?
There's a few things going on. There appears to be this sort of 50, it's about a 50-year cycle where you go through storm intensive periods
uh-huh.
and storm calm periods. And I think it was 2 or 3 years ago we entered the storm intensive period.
Feels like a storm intensive period.
Yeah, you know, so that's one thing. So there are these natural long-term cycles, which mm-hmm. I think, I don't work in that, but my understanding is we don't have a really good understanding of what drives those cycles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then that's coupled with warming trends globally because essentially a warmer ocean provides more fuel for these storms.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why when those storms cross in the Gulf of Mexico, that's a huge pool of really warm water that mm-hmm. really fuels the storm.
So they're gaining speed and intensity.
They're gaining speed, intensity,
and energy.
And strength,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, you know, will we even have even more violent storms? Some people have suggested we will. Other people say we don't know. But it's something that definitely we should think about, we should study, because we can't put our heads in the sand and pretend it's not going to affect us if we're having to evacuate southern states
right,
every other
cities.
Week.
Absolutely incredible. Now, what sort of man-made things, what sort of man-made impact was there on the storm surge? I mean, as far as development in the wetlands, there's been a lot of talk of things that we've done in the way that it was developed along the coastline that sort of may have added to the damage of the storm.
Yeah, I mean, like when you have a storm surge, you know, what you want is for that energy and water to be absorbed
mm-hmm.
prior to hitting cumen dense areas.
Right.
Wetlands are very good at absorbing the water and the energy.
And what's been going on with the wetlands down there?
They've been slowly eroding.
Is that because of the Mississippi pool?
We're diverting water flow to keep the Mississippi flowing really well because that's one of our major shipping ports.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's like 60% of the commerce.
Right.
So it was a huge amount and all kinds of things coming
yeah,
through.
Yeah, and
through.
So you got to make sure that Mississippi's flowing well. So you're diverting water that might want to flow into other wetland areas and
right.
everything like that. And so a massive amount of that wetlands area, and there's a bunch of people down the Gulf that study this, see massive erosion. I think it's like a football field every 5 minutes or something
wow.
like this.
And
so,
football field every 5 minutes.
Yeah,
of
it's like it's some amazing statistic like that. And, you know, think about just that if a hurricane gets weaker when it's not over the ocean and now you don't have, you know, these, you know, hundreds of miles of wetland to absorb a lot of that energy
before it gets to people.
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
we've eroded hundreds of miles of wetland.
I don't know exactly what it is. I just know it's a lot.
Wow.
You know, and you know, it's one of those things where when everyone's talking about the reconstruction down there, there's a lot of discussion about, well, we should really try to rebuild those wetlands, because
mm-hmm.
They'll pay for themselves.
I think that's a really important part of this project is to get some of those wetlands back and protect us.
Oscar, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us and explain some of the more interesting things that have been going on.
Thanks so much, Oscar.
No problem.
Take care.
Take it easy.
That was Oscar Schoenfeld. He's an associate professor of marine biology and ocean optics at Rutgers University, and he was here talking with us about things we've done in the past, what the storm has done down to the Gulf States, and maybe some things we might be able to do a little bit better in the rebuilding. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we talked a lot about Hurricane Katrina and some of the effects on the food supply and the marine life down there and some of the ways that we can protect it. I feel the need to go to a little lighter topic.
Lighten me up, baby.
So, Francis.
Yeah.
Just a quick quiz for you. You know I have a dog, right?
Yep.
What would you say that dog weighs? 35 pounds,
yep.
36 pounds, 37 pounds.
Yep.
Can you explain to me why a person,
yeah.
and I'm not naming anybody, my wife,
yeah.
Would feel the need to buy 50 pounds of food at a time for that dog? That's very similar.
It's an American mania.
It is American. These large stores, the Costcos and BJ's and Sam's Clubs of the world, have corrupted our minds into thinking that we need to buy our dog food 50 pounds at a time. That's very much like me saying, honey, you know, there are six of us in the family. Can you go to the grocery store? I think we need about 700 pounds of food. Okay, can you go? I think we're going to need 90 pounds of pork chops, 125 pounds of ribeye.
I've seen your dog eat, first of all. And it's not as ridiculous once you've seen your dog eat. But the second thing is, you know, it's interesting. There is... To change our focus on food, to change the obesity problem that we have, to change a lot of our problems, the fad diets.
Right.
Okay? Here's the deal. If you want to lose weight, you need to eat less food.
But big is more, baby.
And the problem is our culture, for some reason, and it's funny because this doesn't exist in a lot of European countries. They're like, why would you want 32 ounces of soda in a cup?
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
Why would you do that?
It's 48 ounces, 64 ounces,
and somehow,
72 ounce soda.
It's grown to be this like value thing,
mm-hmm.
because and what's interesting is it's like why you get a bottomless cup of coffee or a bottomless soda.
Right.
Once you've paid to be there, it really only costs me 11 cents to put more
mm-hmm.
soda in your glass. And once you've paid for the glass and you've paid for all that stuff, but. Why do you want more is the
right.
question. And I think that our
average... Because every once in a while, Francis, you just have to buy a 7-pound block of cheddar. You got to have it.
But
got to have it. 42 pounds of sausage. Bring it on.
But what disturbs me more is what's going on in restaurants and fast food restaurants and in 7-Elevens and Wawa's all across the country. What you have to stop and ask yourself, what we have to stop and ask ourselves is, and we have to teach our kids,
right.
is that, you know, getting a 12-ounce soda for 50 cents... is good. Getting a 30-ounce soda for 60 cents is not necessarily
mm-hmm.
better.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to have more. And there's a psychological thing where we eat what's put in front of us.
Yeah. Well, we've just, our whole culture has gone to big is more, supersize me, and bring on the 12-pound bag of chips from Costco.
Where I say if you eat really good food, you need less of it because you get that little bit of pleasure, and we need to just stop ourselves.
Well.
You hear me? Just stop yourself.
I hear you, but I'm still a big fat guy because
yeah.
I eat too much.
Well, no, but I also think it's about preparing good food and eating meals at home. And if
mm-hmm.
you eat good meals with good food and it's not instant processed stuff, you're going to eat less.
You'll do better.
That's my philosophy. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 12 noon.